So a couple of years ago, when I began my ministry, I remember a funeral that I had done, and when I meet with families before a funeral, the conversation of the service comes up and which text to use. And as a pastor, I want to honor the deceased if they had a favorite text. If not, then perhaps the family had a text that would speak to them in such a situation. I think it's good pastoral care, but also it is a way to avoid preaching on John 14 every single funeral. A woman named Curly had passed away, and she was known for her love of pigs. She had tens, if not hundreds, of little ceramic figurines all over her house. Looking back, I had thought to perhaps use this text. This was the only one I could think of that had pigs in such a way. Wisely, I chose not to use this text. Although, as we shall see, perhaps it would not have been a bad message for that day. Before we get into the text, we need to remind ourselves of a couple of things that have gone on already in the book of Mark. Jesus has begun his public ministry, and he does so after his baptism. And the very first thing he does is he ministers in Jewish territory. And the very first act he does is, lo and behold, he heals someone of an unclean spirit, exorcises a Jewish man in Jewish territory, even in the synagogue. Ministry goes on. Right before the scene we have today, we hear of Jesus crossing the sea. Today's text, he's on the other side of it, but coming across the sea is when the storm whipped up. And the disciples in the boat were very afraid. Jesus said, "Ye little faith," and calms the storm. And this just wasn't a meteorological miracle. It was a statement about who God is and the power that God has, even through Jesus here in this world, to quell the chaos and the evil that lurks in the world and threatens life and wholeness. So Jesus comes with his disciples today on the other side of the sea. Sea might be a stretch. It was a very large lake. He gets to the other side. Now he is in Gentile territory. Was there a great sign that said, "You are now entering Gentile territory"? Probably not. But you didn't have to get too far in, perhaps, until you began to smell the pigs. And then you knew you were in Gentile territory, as of course the kosher laws say that pigs are unclean. Jesus steps out of the boat. Immediately someone, a man from the tombs, with an unclean spirit. There's more uncleanliness. We think of the word demoniac, we think of demons, perhaps, Hollywood representations of the devil. But from a Jewish perspective, that uncleanliness was really the threat. The man has this unclean spirit. We hear of this horrific scene, and it's easy to gloss over. It's a story, it's a few verses, but just take a moment and imagine what this man must have gone through. Like a chained dog out in the wilderness. We even hear that he's incapable of human speech at one point, that he's howling. And of course, there's the pain and the bruising and the self-harm. The horrific scene. Well, he approaches Jesus. He sees Jesus from a distance. He runs. He bows down before him. Perhaps not an act of worship, but of deference at least. For immediately we hear that the spirit, at least within the man, realizes who Jesus is and the power that Jesus has as the Son of God. "What have you to do with me, Jesus?" Echoing the words we hear from the Jewish demoniac on the other side of the sea, do not torment me. An interesting request from someone who was a tormentor, the unclean spirits of this poor man living amongst the dead. Jesus says, come out of him. Come out, unclean spirit. This is a bit of a repartee. Jesus asked, what is your name? Again, in the Bible, that's a key thing. To have someone's name meant that you had power over them, or at least a more intimate familiarity. We think of the story where God gives Moses God's name. That's not just a hello, my name is, for recognition. It is a sense of intimacy, an invitation to relationship. And so Jesus asked the man, what is your name? It's an establishing, an establishment of a relationship. The man replies, my name is Legion. For we are many. Quite a shivering scene. One commentator said if this was a horror movie, the lighting and the music would have changed here. We are many. We know the word legion is a military word. A word used by the Roman armies could be up to 6,000 men. They thought usually it was between 4,000 and 5,000, it's a lot of soldiers. My name is Legion. Could have been almost any other name, but that's the name by which the unclean spirit goes. And perhaps we are struck in the gospel story by that intersection of faith and politics. Of course, the Roman force is occupying Judea, occupying the area in which Jesus is doing his ministry, and I don't think it's any coincidence that the unclean spirit chooses this name. Something outside of the Bible, the extra biblical detail, apparently, according to historians, that the banner of the legion that was in charge of Judea and the area surrounding on their flag, guess what they had as a symbol? A boar. A pig. My name is Legion, for we are many. There's this begging that Jesus would handle them with mercy, handle their fate with mercy. So the unclean spirits look around, they see the pigs, let us go there. And so Jesus gives permission, the unclean spirits come out of the man, enter the swine, and the herd, about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and were drowned. What a scene that must have been. To get that many pigs stampeding must have been quite a sight. Pigs perhaps had no idea what was going on, acting frantically, diving off the bank to their death. Well, those who own the pigs are quite upset, understandably perhaps. And they run off and they tell all who would listen, city and country. And people come to the site to see what had happened. Perhaps after the shock of torn up turf between where the herd was and between the sea, imagine 8,000 hooves, they see a quieter scene. The demoniac is sitting there, clothed and in his right mind. Wow. Those who knew this man as feral, as less than human, now see someone who has been restored. someone who has been claimed to bear the image of God. Those who've seen what happened, told what happened with the swine, the people began to beg Jesus to leave their neighborhood. Another detail that perhaps we should pause and think about for a moment. What are they so threatened by? Is it the loss of a herd that, who knows what that must have cost, but it perhaps somebody's complete livelihood just vanished in the blink of an eye? Are they threatened by this Jewish man that doesn't honor any kind of boundaries, any kind of sense of where his place is? That he would come from Jewish territory, enter into their homes, and do these things? Are they just threatened because the status quo has been shaken a bit? But there seems to be a merciful, loving power that would change things. The very last scene, as Jesus is leaving, he gets into the boat. The man who had been possessed comes and asks that he might follow him. Again, seemingly small detail, but we have already heard several stories about Jesus calling disciples. Right? We hear him call the first, the fishermen, James, John, Peter, Andrew. Then he calls Matthias, the tax collector, calls them to be a part of what he is doing, to follow him, to learn from him, to understand God's message that the kingdom of heaven is here now on earth. But Jesus says, no. Is it because the man would make an unlucky 13? Perhaps something else is going on. He's a Gentile. Maybe something's going on with that. We also talked last couple of weeks, at least last week, about what is in the story of Mark, this understanding that nobody really seems to know who Jesus is except the unclean spirits, the Lucifer himself. It's not until the death on the cross that someone, a human, finally gets it, and it's the centurion that says, surely this was the Son of God. So Jesus tells folks, don't tell them about this. Don't tell them who I am. Not yet. Yet here he does the opposite. He tells the man, go, let everybody know. Why this reversal? Is it the exception that proves the rule? I don't know. Perhaps, again, it has something to do with this man being a Gentile. This man, having gone through what he went through, he can be a witness in this Gentile territory. Jesus moves on. What are we to glean from this story? I think there's a couple of things. Perhaps the first is to hear the frustration, perhaps the anger of those who had owned the herds, those who had kept this man in chains. At what cost are we willing to pay for the health and the wholeness of those whom are part of our communities? Those who earn the herds are upset that the great cost has been spent. While our hearts can go out to them, we also understand, is there a price you can put on a human's health and wholeness? What lengths are we willing to go to include those we would otherwise exclude, to provide for them, that they might have dignity, and again, that health and that wholeness? Or do we look for excuses? For reasons to say, no, it's not worth it. Jesus, of course, would go ultimately to the cross. We know that any extension of a gift of life and health and wholeness costs something. And we are aware that Jesus gave us eternal life at the cost of his own death. Perhaps the greatest thing we can do is to understand what God has done. In those last few verses, Jesus does these great things and then says, go and tell. We are not bound by Mark's messianic secret. Jesus does not say to us, tell no one. Instead, we are to let our light shine. Put our lamp on the stand, as we heard last week. To let the world know what God has done. For us, for those who are beyond the boundaries, or perhaps the safe and the sane, that we might follow the example of this man and go to the Decapolis, that is the 10 cities, telling how much Jesus has done for us, to share with those our stories of a God who would become one of us, establish the kingdom, and invite all to join. Perhaps then folks will be amazed.